Blog Talk Radio.
Blender, hosted by author Stephen James and Susan May Warren. This is where you hear great storytellers talk about great stories. Stephen and Susan have a very special guest tonight, Hollywood script consultant Linda Seeger. So if you want to know about writing for Hollywood and what's in store and how to do it and the little ins and outs and secrets, you want to listen to this program because Linda has shared her secrets that has taught Hollywood studios, ABC, NBC, CBS, universities, and film schools across the globe. So this is one that you don't want to miss if you are looking into that direction for your writing. We also want to let you know about Dark Renaissance Books. You check out Dark Renaissance Books on the internet, .com, and see what they have cooking up. KensingtonBooks.com is another great place to go and see their new releases. And go to SilkReel.com. to see the latest on Kevin Hurley and his latest book, Cut and Cover. Of course, you want to see 8 Films to Die For on our webpage. You want to check that. Look at that trailer. Very cool stuff going on. Got a lot of things coming up in the new year. We're going to be taking a couple breaks here at the end of the year. So make sure you stay tuned and get on iTunes and get the podcast to you wherever or however you listen to podcasts, whatever format you like it in, it will ship right to you when everything is done and you won't miss a thing. So let's just jump into it right now with the Story Blender with very special guest Linda Seeger. Take it away, Stephen and Susan.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Susan May Warren.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And Susan, this is kind of a neat day because we're talking with someone who's not only an expert in story, but also in screenplays.
Oh, I know. This is just going to be so great. I have sat under her teaching before and just came away with my head exploding with great stuff. So this is going to be a fantastic interview. I'm so excited that she's here.
Well, let me introduce our guest, Linda Seeger. As one of Hollywood's most renowned and well-respected script consultants, Linda has given seminars, lectured, and worked in 34 countries on 6 continents. Over the years, she's consulted on more than 2,000 scripts, including over 50 produced feature films and 35 produced television projects. She has given seminars for studios and networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, universities, and film schools across the globe, including training other script consultants in Germany, New Zealand, Scandinavia, Austria, and Italy. Linda has written 12 books, 9 of them on screenwriting, including the best-selling book, Making a Good Script Great, Creating Unforgettable Characters and Writing Subtext. Ron Howard has endorsed Making a Good Script Great, saying he has used this book to inform all of his movies, beginning with Apollo 13. So, Linda, we are super excited that you could be here today.
Good. I am excited, too. Looking forward to our chat.
Well, we love to kind of get to the heart of a story. And when you look at a script, maybe from an aspiring writer or maybe even an experienced writer, what are some of the things that you look at that you find often as weaknesses in the stories that people are trying to put out there today?
Most of the weaknesses come from a lack of focus. That the writer swerves all over, their ideas change, maybe their stories take detours. So some of it has to do with structure. Do they have a clear beginning, middle, and end? Do they actually pay off and develop what they set up? So, for instance, I'm working on a story right now. I'm consulting. And the writer is a beautiful writer, but has actually set up about 6 different stories. And they he leaves one and goes to the next and then leaves that one and goes to the next. And so there are detours along the way rather than this clear focus that says, this is the story I want to tell. It has a beginning, middle, and end. It is clear. I have a theme. I have characters that serve the theme in the story. Everything is integrated. Everything is working as a whole.
So finding that unity, I wonder if it has something to do with, you know, a lot of the storytelling today on television and in film is very complex. And not only complex, it has sometimes dozens of characters when you look at some of the television shows that have been big hits over the last decade. And I wonder if people are just writing diffuse stories because they're not, like you said, as focused, but maybe that's just they're trying to be too aggressive and telling too big of a story to start with. I don't know.
Sometimes they have a whole lot of ideas and they don't know how to rein them in. But the other thing is telling a story for television where you have multiple episodes and you can go off and pursue one idea and move back to another as long as there's an overriding idea, that can work. But when you have 2 hours for a television, or if you only have a book's worth, maybe you have to be careful depending on the size of your books, but you've got to hold the reader. And if you start changing storylines, you start changing the theme.
Mm-hmm.
So every story has a theme that you're exploring or an idea. And if you start out saying, well, my theme is greed, and then later on my theme is love, and no, it's really about integrity, again, you're all over the place.
That's fantastic advice. Don't mind me while I sit here and take notes. So that's really so true, though. And, you know, obviously when you're script writing, you've got this major theme, and does every character in the screenplay and, of course, in the novel interact with that theme then? Is that the best way to do that, or are there variations of the theme that you encourage people to move off of, or how do you, you know, what's your best advice when it comes to writing around a theme?
Well, one of the things I notice, about 85% of all stories have a theme about identity, whether it's about finding identity, transforming identity, affirming your integrity, figuring out who you are, figuring out the meaning of your life, whatever it is, there seems to be an identity theme. But identity can be about integrity, holding on to integrity, or about transformation and change and growth in terms of who you are. So you can play around with a theme, but you still want to keep it really focused.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes a movie or a novel or a story actually plays with a theme of contrast. I have a couple favorite examples. A movie like Dead Poets Society, which is one of my favorite, is a movie about creativity and conformity. And if you look at every character in that story, they will represent one side of that. Either they are the conformists, like the parents and some of the school teachers, or they are the creative, like Mr. Keating, or they are the movement, conformity to creativity, which some of the boys take. Another good example is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is liberation versus oppression. Again, every character will represent an aspect of the theme. This idea of the versus, where the theme is a contrast, it's not used very much, but some of the greatest films will have that contrast in it. And so I'm using older examples because I can't say I've seen it recently, but I just love it when I see that working with two different ideas.
Yeah, I think that's really, really interesting, and that does make for a really powerful story when each character, you know, you've got a couple different themes going on and characters interacting in those different themes. So that's fantastic. Do you think that helps streamline the plot as well when we stick to one theme and makes it easier for the reader to access and understand the story better?
Yes, because everything is a unity. Aristotle talked about the unity of time, place, and action. And we don't do unity of time as much, but or even unity of place, because especially films, novels, they can move all over. But there is the sense of unity of action and unity of theme. And same thing with characters aren't just put in there because somebody wants to honor their mother. And so they'll have a lovely mother character. Every character serves the story. And sometimes what happens is writers just fill their story with so many characters and they don't really have a reason to be there. So one of the things one always asks is, what's the function of the character? How is the character either supporting the protagonist or being the resistant or the antagonistic force to the protagonist? So a protagonist has allies and they have the antagonist, and is each character moving the action or helping to take the action toward the climax or helping the protagonist achieve the goal? So everyone has a reason to be in the story, and they're just not an arbitrary presence.
That's so great. when you were talking a minute ago about themes, it got me thinking about a quote that I heard from Flannery O'Connor. I'm going to read it to you. I just looked it up here a second ago, and I'll let you respond to it. A little bit of devil's advocate, maybe, and I don't really know. Anyway, here it is. She said, Flannery O'Connor said, when you can state the theme of a story, when you can separate it from the story itself, then you can be sure the story is not a very good one. The meaning of a story has to be embodied in it, has to be made concrete in it. A story is a way to say something that can't be said any other way, and it takes every word in the story to say what the meaning is. What's your take on that, on Flannery's view about theme?
I adore Flannery. What a woman. I took a class on her actually in seminary, because I have this theology degree. And what I think we're really in total agreement that the theme is embedded in the story. It's not just that the theme is on your right and the story is on your left. It's that the story is representing and showing the theme and putting the theme into a process. Because a story moves. It's not about static. It's not about episodes or people standing still. It's about people moving on a journey, and that the meaning of the theme comes through what the writer does with that journey. So if everyone dies in some chaotic event at the end, the writer might be saying life is chaotic. If things work out well, the writer might be saying something about hope. If the characters transform through the process of the story, the writer is saying that we actually can grow and change. We can be redeemed. We can find something good, and that the journey or the process of the journey takes us someplace that is maybe better than if we hadn't gone on the journey. So again, it's an integration and that intersection that we're looking at. And again, it gets back to things are not arbitrary in a story. And sometimes what happens is in the writer's first draft, everything gets thrown in because the writer is finding his or her way. Mm-hmm. And then they begin to sort it out and say, this is what I meant to say. I interviewed Tom Shulman many years before, who wrote Dead Poets Society, and he said, it wasn't till I finished the draft that I realized this was about creativity and conformity. I was just writing something I felt and something that interested me, and then all of a sudden I said, oh, I see. So now I can go back and rewrite it with that in mind.
Nice, that's interesting, you know. When I work on a new novel, I try to approach it from the perspective of a moral dilemma or a question rather than a theme as much, I guess. But so for example, instead of saying the theme is justice, the question would be, what's more important, protecting the innocent or telling the truth? Yeah, so to dive into a moral dilemma, so for example, with my first book, I mean, my question was, what makes me different from those who do the unthinkable? And I explored kind of the aspects of both a serial killer but also the people who died at the Jonestown Massacre back in the 70s and what makes me different from those people. And for me, I find that this kind of helps open up ideas and dilemma and conflict within the story. So I'm always interested in when people talk about themes because it's not something I ever have done, and I don't, like, attempt to do that. But I think that I still shoot for that unity that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that every writer has this strength in this place that they start from, and they have to eventually learn how to deal with the elements that might be weaker. But that's intriguing. You start with the moral dilemma. I know some writers who start with theme. Not a lot. They tend to be European, maybe Australian. I know some that start with character. I know some that start with story. And then they have to figure out how to integrate. Now, it's interesting because as a script consultant, I have a lot of strength in story and structure. And so when I look at a script or even a novel, I am actually consulting on a novel right now, I am looking for the story and making sure the story is cohesive. When I was starting to work in drama and went through college and then graduate school, one of my weaker parts was theme. So when I went to seminary, I was partly going to seminary to strengthen this idea of how do stories communicate values and communicate ideas without getting preachy. So I spent 5 years in seminary.
Well, what's the answer? What's the answer? How do they?
Yes, as you work with images, you work with character, you embed the story and the theme into, you actually embed the theme and the idea into the story and the characters and the images. But then I was not as good at character. Now, one of the problems was probably because I was a terrible actor. I got a C in acting in graduate school. They literally did not allow me to go to the next class. If you got a C, you were out of your acting class. That was the end of your career. And so, but I took some weekend acting classes, and I read a lot about acting because I thought, well, if character is my weakness, then I have to work on that. So, and then I began to work a lot on visuals because movies are about images and visuals. And I spent probably at least a year doing visual thinking every day and giving myself challenges. I read books on how to develop yourself as a visual thinker. So several really marvelous books on this, and I would see where my weakness was, and then I would say, okay, 10 minutes of exercises a day to learn how to be a visual thinker. So I think I have a very strong sense of images at this point. But I'm aware when I work with writers of what is their weakness and what is their strength, and many times in my report I'll send them to books or I'll say watch these movies in order to just start developing that part of you that needs developing. And we're just always constantly developing our skill as writers.
That's nice. We spoke with Davis Bunn in a previous interview, and he talked about a similar thing of really identifying your weaknesses and working on them. And he said most people try to identify their strengths and then kind of stay in that area. But to really grow as a creative artist, you need to continually reevaluate, you know, where you are, your weaknesses, and then work on honing those. That's interesting.
Yes, and I adore him. He has endorsed one or two of my books, and just what a wonderful person he is, and lovely writer. So that's great. We're in agreement on that.
You guys are on the same page.
Yes.
You wrote a book called Writing Subtext, What Lies Beneath. Did a lot of your visual thinking and training go into that particular book? Because this is a really interesting book about, you know, images and things like that that happen in film.
So did you take that information and sort of put it in there? How do, you know, because that's...
Certainly I pulled everything I knew into that book. The publishers of my book, it was called And the Best Screenplay Goes To, it was a book examining some of the Academy Award-winning screenplays like Sideways, Shakespeare in Love, and Crash. Mm-hmm. That publisher said, would you write a book on writing subtext? Well, there wasn't a book out on that subject, which means I had to figure it out. So I started to talk to people. I started to think. I came up with, I started to think, what were the scripts or the films that I thought definitely had subtext, and could I figure it out from just looking at those? And two that I saw immediately were Ordinary People and Shadow of Doubt, an old Alfred Hitchcock one. And I read the scripts, I watched the films, and I said, what is going on underneath the surface? And then I began to look for the patterns. Then I started thinking of everything I'd ever learned in my life about drama, and I started to think about personal examples. Had I encountered subtext in the world? Where did I see it with my friends? Where did I get confused? And if I found many times traveling, you come across subtext because your hosts in another culture don't want to tell you not to do something. But you just notice people look at you strange, or suddenly people are not as warm as they were, or they say something, and then you try to find someone to tell you what the subtext is, and it's very hard to figure it out. You just know there's subtext, you don't know what it is. Now, that book is going to have a new edition. The book is due as a new edition May 1st, which tells me it'll probably come out next fall. I'm going to update some examples. I'm going to keep Ordinary People, Shadow and Doubt. I think if you watch those two movies, you learn an awful lot about subtext, and there's probably not better movies for that. But I'm updating some examples. I'm pulling in some others. And I've also been thinking a lot more about examples from real life. So I'm going to create little scenarios and to talk about how you have to say that there's something going on. What in the world is going on here?
Right.
Because
right.
It's not clear. So it was a fascinating book. It was a fascinating book because most of the time when you write a book, there's other books in the area, in that area, that are out. I mean, you write my first screenwriting book, Making a Good Script Great. Well, Sid Field's books in screenwriting had been out for 8 or 10 years. But then there were all those playwriting books. I mean, there was a whole body of knowledge out there that I'd learned a lot over the years and developed my own theories. To write a book where there's nothing out there, the publisher, I rarely say no. I probably never have said no. If somebody says, would you write a book on this? I think, well, sure, I can learn it. And so it was such an interesting challenge to be the first person out there. Sort of, other people had thought about it. Other people had written maybe a couple pages in a book on screenwriting, but no one had written a whole book on that, and particularly for screenwriters.
I have a friend named Leonardo Wild who's from Quito, Ecuador, and he's a screenwriter and a novelist, and he loves that book of yours and has used it and has taught subtext and referenced your book here in the States. And so I thought that was kind of fascinating. I wanted to be sure to let you know that even in Ecuador, they're using your subtext ideas.
Oh, lovely.
So do you think, so following up on that, do you think it's that deeper layer that adds, you know, the adding in of subtext and even, you know, staying around one theme or story question is what I call it. Do you think that's what makes a great, you know, a good screenplay great, is going to that deeper level? Or what does make a great, you know, a good screenplay go from good to great?
Well, I have certainly seen some great films that I don't think are loaded with subtext. They basically do their job extremely well, and they can be in any genre. I mean, through the years, I have often referenced Witness, which is a detective story. If he says there are a lot of subtexts there, I'd say, no, I don't think so. I think it's a pretty straight ahead and story, and most of the time an action story or an adventure story. I mean, doesn't matter what's out there. I went to see Everest 2 weeks ago. I don't think there's much subtext in Everest. This man
right.
against the mountain. And it's not a great movie, but it's a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that subtext in certain movies, I think dramas, subtext becomes maybe more important.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
you can play with subtext in a wonderful way in comedies. And a lot of subtext has to do with really working on the words. To say, if I change my word, do I get another level of meaning? I thought of an example, which will probably go in the new edition, is that you think of a movie like The Proposal, Sandra Bullock's the boss, and she's
mm-hmm.
got this attractive young man, that if she were getting him ready for an important meeting where he's going to be her assistant in the meeting, she could say, well, I need to prepare you for the meeting. But instead, she could say, I need to groom you for the meeting.
Mm.
Meeting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now we got another level of meaning because of the word groom, which might be unconscious on the character's part, but we in the audience say, oh, yeah, he'd make a really cute groom. I think
mm-hmm.
there's underlying attraction.
Right, right.
So the writer many times just spends time on saying, I wonder if I could find a word that has more resonance. And a lot of subtext is resonance. It's trying to get something to ripple out so it just doesn't mean one thing. Sometimes the resonance comes from the actor playing the line. I mean, if somebody says, what's wrong, and you say, nothing, oh, I'm fine. Okay, it's okay. Yeah, it's pretty good. Right away you know, huh, I don't think Linda's telling me the real meaning.
Right.
So the way that I say fine can carry the subtext. But I might also use another word instead of fine that, you know, if I say, yeah, I'm okay.
Right.
It's like, what's not so good?
Right.
So you play with that word and you might go through a whole lot of words to say, it's going to take me a while. This is not the first draft stuff. This is what happens after I work. I asked a really great dialogue writer once, I said, how many times do you rewrite a scene? And she said, oh, I rewrote 122 times this morning. Now, she was a comedy writer, so I don't know if it was 22 or 19 or 14.
Right.
I know what she was saying was, I worked and I worked and I worked and I kept rewriting and I changed things around and I changed this word. And so that's what great writers do. In fact, sometimes what happens, people think the difference between a good writer and a great writer is talent, but usually it's that the great writer has rewritten it more often and kept refining and didn't just let it go. And the other writers say, well, you know, this is how it came out.
That's a great,
that's a great point. You're supposed to work on it.
Yeah.
Wow, I love that.
Finding the right word is so, you know, so key in looking at it. And I think a lot of writers just don't either know or take the time to put it in and say every word, every piece of punctuation, whatever, affects the flow, the pace, the tone of this story, this novel, or maybe the screenplay. And it needs to serve the story.
One of the things I learned, I wrote this book, Making a Good Writer Great, on creativity. And after I did that, I also found it was very freeing because I didn't get too concerned when things didn't flow. I learned to say, I'm just in process. And when I don't know the word, I put some possible words in parentheses, and then I go back to it, but I try to keep the flow of the writing going. And I think it's all right if I don't know that word in the first draft. I just know that the word I've chosen that maybe has the right meaning but not the right resonance is not very exciting. And I love, I found as I've written more, I love to play with words. In Making a Good Writer Great, one of my sentences was, the tools of a writer are minimal, something to write with, something to write on, and something to write about. And I was so proud of this. First of all, I just loved playing with prepositions. You're never supposed to end a sentence with a preposition. And it was so much fun to write that sentence and just kind of smile over it. And I had another one, and I can't remember it was in that book. I used the term hardcore horror and gore to describe horror movies. And what I loved about that sentence was that you can't say it. You can read it, but you can't really say it without really having your mouth tripping up. And so I think that one of the things a writer learns to do is to just to have fun with words. And I've noticed now, because actually I've written 13 books now and several editions of some of those books, I notice that I'm willing to have more fun with words. I look at the flow. I look at the rhythm. I'm willing to work more with the word. I'm willing to rework the chapter. I think more about flow. I read it out loud, and I say, my mouth is tripping over this. So even though someone's not reading my book out loud, they are still getting into that flow of the language. And if I'm tripping on it out loud, they might be tripping on it as a reader. And so, and of course, one hopes for a good editor. I certainly have editors that catch things like repetitions, or they catch a lot of my commas are in the wrong place, but which will really improve the sentence. But also just recognizing, oh, this sentence could be done better, and it's a little awkward, or it's a little unclear, whatever it is. So one of the things with writing is, if you're a writer, if you're not having joy in the writing, you might want to do something else, because nobody makes anybody write. They might make you do other things, you know, like like get the whatever that get the manufacturers, whatever you're doing out there, or get the deadline, or get this report done. But nobody makes you write from your heart. You only do that because you love doing it. And there are writers that for some reason think they're supposed to write but don't like it. And the problem is that you get, you in a sense get so little reward back from writing, in the sense that you then have to sell your work. It's really hard to sell your work. Most of the things you write don't make a lot of money. You better enjoy what you're doing, because you're not getting that other reward. You're getting the internal. And you hope people who write want to keep learning to write better. So it's a process.
Yeah. Being continually teachable. And sometimes willing to start over, you know, when you look at it and you realize that it's maybe not as strong as you wanted, and you're willing to take a step back and move into the story maybe from a different perspective.
Yeah, is print out your first drafts on scratch paper so you can throw it away and not feel bad about destroying pretty white paper.
It's good.
So, because there is that sense, you can easily hold on to something. When I was writing Creating Unforgettable Characters, one chapter, I thought, this is really a terrible chapter. And I circled, so when I evaluate my own work, the first thing I do is I circle what's good. And out of 15 pages, there were 3 sentences.
Oh.
I said, and I thought, this is probably the worst chapter ever written in the history of the world, but there are 3 sentences I really like. And I just went back and I started to rework. And sometimes what happens, I think, is we skim the surface whether it's in the story or I write nonfiction. I mean, I'm not writing scripts. I'm consulting on scripts, but I'm writing nonfiction. And I know sometimes I'll read things and say, I've heard that before. Yeah. That's not fresh. Now, let me see how deep can I get into it. And I have a friend who sometimes just says to me, have you told the truth? I said, yeah, I've told part of the truth. I haven't told the whole truth, the heartfelt truth, the inside truth. I haven't gone deep enough or profound enough. I haven't found that what I can say that nobody else has said or hasn't said in the way I've said it. And so, of course, you pray a lot, too. I mean, you pray before you write a lot of times and just say, God, help me to get into this, that how do I get deep enough into this that I really am of help? Because the best thing someone can say to anybody about their writing is, that helped me, or, oh, I just loved it, or it made me feel a certain way, or it helped me on a journey, or it helped me clarify something, or it pulled me. I mean, that something is supposed to happen between the reader and the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's lovely when somebody says, I mean, in my case with nonfiction books, when someone said, that helped me or that changed my writing or it helped me get through or it kept my job. I mean, I had one of the women who used to write for Everybody Loves Raymond said, I got the job on my talent and I realized I didn't know what I was doing. Your book saved my life and saved my career because I grabbed your book and I just started using it. And and she was on that job for a number of years.
Wow.
So
that is a fun affirmation of what you do, and that's really cool. And so, but I love what you said about, you know, have you told the truth? Have you told the whole heartfelt truth? You know, and just kind of digging deep. And in your book, Making a Good Writer Great, you write about how we all have a dark side, and so should our characters. And so you actually write, the dark side, the shadow world, is laden with gold-buried treasures that round out a character's personality when used wisely. So talk to us a little bit about that, the aspect of darkness in crafting believable characters.
Well, we can be in denial about our own dark side, and sometimes it's just good not to let it out in public, but to recognize your reaction. You hear a motorcycle driver going past, and there's a little tiny part of you that said, I'd just like to knock that guy over. He's so loud, and he's disturbing me. And you look at yourself, and you want to say, oh, my gosh, did I actually think that? I mean,
right.
What a horrible, terrible thing to think of harming someone. And you
right.
said, you know what I did? And we all have that in us. We like to pretend we don't, but we have
right.
it. And we have flaws. I mean, we don't necessarily have evil, ugly things, but we have flaws and imperfections, and we get caught up in unclarities and all of that. And to look at that, and sometimes a mythologist, I know Pamela J. Smith, said that dark side is not necessarily evil. It's the shadow that has not been awakened. And sometimes you want to keep that shadow unawake, but other times you want to be aware of it. For instance, I grew up in a musical-educated family. We read books. We played music, but we didn't hike. We didn't do a lot of physical activity. It wasn't like I grew up playing tennis or something. Well, somebody could say that was my shadow, was that physical outdoing things. So I eventually got into horseback riding, and about 12 years ago, I got my first horse, and I started doing horse shows, and 20 years ago, I started doing these one-week horseback rides, and I challenged myself on this physical side of being more physically, I guess we could say, in tune, you know, doing things that maybe when I was younger, I wasn't confident, didn't think I was very good at it. It was just that I wasn't affirmed. So that was my shadow. And I think those shadows, whether it's somebody who says, well, I was very physical and I realized I loved intellectual things, but I wasn't very good at it, so I didn't do it. And then when I was 40, I started a master's degree. You know, that thing many times we go back to when we're older to balance us. I know executives in Hollywood that started taking tango lessons, and they got deeply into tango. I mean, these were people that were workaholics and intellectual and business people, really got into tango because they felt that need to find a balance for what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, the dark sort of nasty side that sometimes can come up and that somebody needs to be in touch with, because you're writing protagonist and antagonist in a story. And if your antagonist is just so nice, they're not going to have very much conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a recognition we have a lot of layers to us as people, and the characters need to have layers, and we have things we admire, and if we're really truthful, we say, you know, I got some things in me that I wish they were a little better.
Yeah, I like the idea of putting your character's dark side into a novel. I think that's really fantastic. You know, just because we're always like, oh, we want them to be likable. We want people to love them. Well, they're not real if they don't have a dark side. So
nice. I mean, sometimes people are just so nice. And
right.
Yes, because even the nicest people I know have things that you say, oh, that kind of drives me a little nuts, or they're not really very clear. I wish they were a little smarter, or whatever it is, that we
right.
all have those things. That I wish this were a little better.
Wow, that's
like
good.
It.
Yeah, me too.
Like,
it's good advice.
Your advice on the truth, like telling the truth, and also the different layers that we have as people, some of them darker, some shadows, and so on. I think one of the big keys that I'm taking away from this is really you have to understand yourself and have the courage to not only explore the depths of your own emotions and insights and so on, but the courage to tell the full truth about the world and not shy away from it. I think a lot of storytelling just shies away from it.
And in a sense, especially with story, people tell stories based on their own experience. And then they tell stories based on what they have seen, that is, their friends, or stories they have heard, or stories where they have seen something going on. And that reality, to me, is always far more interesting than when people just make it up clearly out of their imagination and then get the facts wrong. So people will tell a story. Let's say that somebody tells a medical story and you realize they've never witnessed an operation, they've never been in a hospital, they've never had any scientific training. They are telling a story about something they know nothing about, so they don't know the truth about it. I had a student in a class one time. She said, I'm going to write about a family that goes on an African safari. And I said, have you been to Africa? And she said, no. I said, have you been on a safari? No. Are you fascinated with wild animals? Well, not particularly. I said, find another subject. There's
right.
no way that person could get at the truth of that because she hasn't lived any of it. She's just coming up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Say this is not your voice, and I read a lot of scripts where people have their information so wrong, and there's many things I don't know about, but many times I have a feeling or an inkling that something is not right. But there's a lot of stuff I do know about just because I've had wide experiences, and I'll read a racehorse story and I'll say, but horses don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is it really? I said, well, I had a horse for 10, I actually over 10 years, I had 4 horses. And I said, I learned a lot about horses and what they do, and they don't do that you're just showing. And sometimes I grew up in a musical family, and sometimes doing something about music, and say, well, that's not really how you practice piano or you've described a piano that's really a Steinway, but you called it something else. And, you know, I mean, so certain things over the years, you say it's got to be accurate, it's got to be right. And that's what we mean by the voice of the writer, that the writer is writing about something that comes from inside, and it's their clear voice. It's not just grabbing something out of the air.
When you look, Linda, today at film or television, who do you consider to be some of the best storytellers in film today, and what would you say makes them so great?
Well, there's a couple. First of all, there's a lot of movies I want to get excited about, and I don't. And in television, a couple of my colleagues say, oh, the best writing is on television, and I'll watch some of these series that they say, oh, this is just great writing. I mean, let's just take whether it's Homeland or House of Cards, or I watch some of True Detective, and some of these I look and say, well, yeah, I would agree that's good writing, but I don't want to be around those people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spend an hour with them. If I knew those people, I would just say, you know what, at a party I'm going to go the opposite direction, because
mm-hmm.
I don't like those kind of people. And what I think has happened with a lot of writing, people think evil or bad is really interesting. I don't think so. I think good is much more interesting and more diverse. And I would love to see more, when I say good characters, I don't just mean dimensional. I mean good people like we see in real life. I know so many fascinating, good, compassionate, caring, kind, sensitive, gentle. I could go on and on with all these words, people in life. And I find them just marvelous people, interesting to be around. And I look at movies, I don't see those people. Like, don't the writers have nice friends? I mean, don't they have people that are not only fascinating, but decent human beings? And,
right.
So
yeah.
I don't, you know, and so many of the movies I see, I think they're doing really well in terms of the look of the movie, but I'm not drawn in. In fact, rarely do I meet a character in a movie that I say, I would like to know that person. So they might fascinate me. One of my favorite characters is from As Good As It Gets, Carol. She is a good, decent, doesn't hold grudges, she's forgiving, she doesn't let people cross boundaries, kind. I mean, I just love that character. She won an Academy Award, you know, I mean, Helen Hunt, for playing that character.
Yeah.
And so now I would like to know her, but let's see, that was in the 1990s, right? So
right
now, and I'm thinking, I don't know. Maybe the woman in Far From the Madding Crowd. I'd like to know her.
Mm-hmm. She was good. That was a great show.
Yeah. So if I see one every 5 years that I say I'd like to hang out with that person, I think that person has a lot to offer me. And then, of course, one looks at movies and I say, I see very few movies that in any way reflect my life or my dilemmas or my concerns or, you know, once in a while I'll see a movie about a writer, maybe, I mean, what is it called, House of Games or something many years ago, main character's a writer, and I said I identified with her, but mostly even the writers. So they're just kind of nasty people. And so I can look at movies about that and say I don't identify with them,
right,
really.
So what are those shows that you do? What are you watching these days? What do you enjoy watching?
Well, it sort of depends on the situation. I'm doing a seminar on genre in Norway in November, and it's the first time I've done a seminar on genre. I was fascinated that they asked me, because they probably knew I'd never done a seminar in genre. And I'm spending 5 days working on their projects. But one of the things I've spent the last months researching genre and coming up with my own theories and reading books. And so I'm making this list of what are the top films in various genres and watching some of them. If you can believe, I watched Die Hard last night because it's
the top 10.
Every time someone says, what are the best action? Die Hard, Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I'm going to be rewatching Raiders and, you know, using some clips in the classes on these. So at the moment, the one thing I told them is I said, I can't do horror. I will talk about horror. We will discuss it. I'm not showing clips. I'm not watching it. I worked on Peter Jackson's Brain Dead, which is called Dead Alive in the U.S., and I was the consultant on that in 1989, and that was his breakthrough film. That was the film that got him known internationally, and I've never watched it. So I thought, well, I'll watch Brain Dead, and I got through about 30 minutes, and it got too much, you know. I just can't. And what is funny is I can work on horror, and I don't have a moral problem with working on horror films, and I can even come up with ideas to make them more horrible. I just don't watch them. So it's been interesting to think through what are the best comedies. What are I've gone back and I rewatched a film noir, The Double Indemnity. So I'd say at the moment I'm rewatching classics, the movies that I think best exemplify the genre. But I'm also you know, I'm looking at, it looks like there's some good movies. I want to see that Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks, and I think, I don't know if it's out or ready to come out. So there'll start to be some of the good fall movies coming out. I did want to see Everest because I read all six books about that 1996, that particular season on Everest. And this was based on that, so that was the last one I saw in 3D IMAX. Talk about being there on the mountain.
Right, and terrifying out there.
Yeah, bring your warm jacket.
Right.
So,
that's great.
Well, Linda, no, this has been great, and I really like ending, too, with this idea of creating characters that people want to spend time with. I think that is a great point. You know, we spoke with Donald Moss at one point, and he brings that up in his book on writing 21st century fiction, and you brought it up, too, without us even really going in that direction. And I think a lot of aspiring authors that I've started to read their stuff, I agree with you. I start reading this book, I'm like, I don't want to spend time with this person, whether he's whiny or immature or just evil or whatever. It's like, I don't want to spend time with them, so I'm not going to spend 10 hours reading your novel
or watching
your show.
And I think the other thing is when we mature, I mean, let's just pretend that the three of us are mature people that have actually had some spiritual development over the last years, is that you say, I want to be with characters that have something to offer me. And I don't mean perfect or nice or unflawed or anything, but people that are rich, that they are improving my life in some way. And I think as we get older, maybe we think about what I'm spending my time on, I want it to offer something good to me because I don't need to wallow. I'm old enough not to wallow and, you say, not to spend time with certain things and say, oh, I already did that. You know, I watched that movie 20 or 30 years ago, and I spent the time, and I watched people shoot each other and do all of that, and okay, so I did that. I don't need to keep doing that. I'd like to get someplace else, unless, of course, I have to do it for a class. And I would say Die Hard is a good action movie, if you want an action movie, but there's an awful lot of shooting, and
yeah.
You say, okay, got it.
Yeah,
Well, there's definitely seasons of our lives that we like to watch certain things, right? And I love that idea of just, you know, creating those characters that people want to spend time with. Do I want to spend time with my character? You know, do I like this, you know, the story? Would I want to, you know, immerse my time in it? So, yeah, I think that's a really great takeaway.
Yeah.
So, Linda, we'd like to recommend our listeners check out your books, your resources. First of all, where's the best place to find them, your website or an online bookstore?
Website,
and which, yeah.
The website is lindasager.com, S-E-G-E-R. But I also have 4 spiritual books out in a new edition of Spiritual Steps on the Road to Success just came out. But there's a separate spiritual website in a Spiritual Steps book. .com, and it has all my spiritual books on one. You can access it through lindasager.com. There'll be a place to click on it. But if you want that, otherwise the writing books are on lindasager.com, and that focuses on consulting and seminars and books, etc.
Cool.
Now, the writing books, this for screenwriters and novelists, is there one that you say, this is one that people should really start with, or maybe a more recent one that you say, man, this one really is unique? And we mentioned a couple different ones. I don't know which one you would say.
Yeah, well, I usually say start with Making a Good Script Great, because it's the basis, and then Making a Good Writer Great, and even read the two together and do all the exercises in Making a Good Writer Great, which will save you a couple years in your writing career. You'll learn things really fast. So those two, but then depending on what your project is, will also depend on where you're led.
All right, fantastic. Well, Linda, it's been great having you here, lots of great insights, and I'm sure people will, whether they're writing novels or screenplays, can totally take away some specifics that will help improve their writing.
Mm-hmm.
And we thank everybody for listening. For information about my books, check out stephenjames.net.
And to find my books, go to SusanMayWarren.com, and to find out more information about writing novels, go to LearnHowToWriteANovel.com.
Check out our other guests and other broadcasts at TheStoryBlender.com, and always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.